Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you. Seems like I have a few friends in this room, huh? It's really cool. Good morning. My name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a very, very grateful recovering alcoholic. I'm going to try to go somewhat slow, not like Steve last night. And I'm a New Yorker, so I have a tendency to zip through my words, but I will try to work with you. Ah, it is so fabulous to be here. It is just so fabulous to be here. I want to say first thank you to the committee, all of you who were responsible for me coming up here. It is for me truly a privilege any time I get to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't matter what I get to do. You know, when I get to say thank you to you on any level, it's like the best thing that could happen. Because there's no way in the world I'd be able to repay you for all you've given me in coming up on 17 years. There's just no way, you know. I know. Steve and I joke because he's only a couple of months over me. Next month I'll be 17. And I remember one conference we spoke at, we were, you didn't say it last night. We were like the oldest. One conference we were the oldest and had the most sobriety. And at another conference we had the least amount of sobriety and we were the youngest. You know, and quite honestly, I felt better when we had the least amount. You know, and that's why last night was so special when we were in here participating in that countdown. It's really important for me to see newcomers in a room. Let me just say that. I love newcomers. I sponsor newcomers. But for me, at this middle stage of recovery, it is important. It is critical for me to be in a room where there are people with more time than me. It's a must. Because otherwise, I get to a point where I think life ends at 17. And I don't want to ever get to that place where I believe that. You know, I know people that drink with more sobriety than 17 years. So I don't ever want to be in a room where I think it ends with what I've got. So last night was just awesome. I mean, I saw people who were sober longer than I'm on this earth, which is incredible. Although I have to tell you, in all honesty, it wasn't that many. I stand up here middle-aged, so no matter how I look, anyway, it was really wonderful to be a part of that last night. I want to say hi to Terry, too. We get to follow each other. He gets to follow me. And one of the nice things about that is they get to see you grow. You know, just like some of you in here. I mean, I have a lot of friends in this room, which is really neat. People that I've seen when I've spoken in many places up in Northern California. People I've really gotten to know a little bit better. People I've known from other places. And one of the nice things I get to hear, especially now, is, wow, I've seen you grow a little bit. You know, I've seen you grow a little bit. So Terry gets to see me grow a little bit, as some of you do. And let me forewarn you, if you have never heard me speak before, I am a crier, and I do not apologize for doing that at the podium. I just don't. So if you have a problem with middle-aged women who don't have a problem crying, then all those doors back there you might want to use because, you know, my friend Bruce, before the meeting, he brought me this whole batch of napkins. He's heard me speak a million times, and he knows. You know, I mean, it may not come, and sometimes it may, and, you know, the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is I let it come. I just let it flow. I don't apologize for having my feelings because, oh, here it comes now, you know. Because God knows I got sober. I grew up on the streets of New York as a really tough street kid with walls around me so thick that I wouldn't let me out and I wouldn't let you in. And I never realized I had a heart until I came to you. And so you taught me how to cry, and unfortunately, you've never taught me how to cut it off a little. So it just flows. But thanks for that gift. Thanks for that gift. It's a softening. Anyway, I want to welcome all of you that are relatively... Oh. Shadow of the leader. It's not bad, you know. I like being that kind of role model where I let people know it's a safe place for them to... I want to welcome those of you that are relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. and just say that you are in for the most incredible experience of your lives. And I know you can't believe that. I know if you're newly sober sitting in this room this morning, the last thing you want to hear is that getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous today or sitting in an AA meeting this morning is the best deal going. And I know that's not what you want to hear. And yet I can only tell you that if you become willing a day at a time to do what's suggested right here, you know, what we suggest, what comes out of not necessarily our mouths, but what comes out of our literature, out of our books. If you become willing a day at a time to do what's suggested, you will find that your lives will take on the kind of shape that you never, ever thought possible. You can't even imagine what's in store for you. You just can't. I stand before you this morning a breathing example of Alcoholics Anonymous, a walking, talking example of recovery in the flesh. People like me don't get to be where I am, but for Alcoholics Anonymous. This doesn't happen. Women who have come from the places I've come from, people who have done the things I've done in my life don't get to show up like I get to show up today, looking relatively clean and smelling okay and in my right mind, knowing who I slept with last night and where I was, you know. That doesn't get to happen except for what you've given me here. Today I'm a woman who walks with dignity. I know how to spell that word, and I know how to define it. And trust me, that wasn't my M.O. when I came in here. It wasn't. You know, and yet, that was just one of the byproducts of getting sober. You know, you told me when I came in here it was about not drinking and not using drugs, and you know what? That was the deal. But what I found once I put that stuff down was a world that opened up to me that was beyond anything I could have imagined for myself. So I'm so glad you guys are here. If you're new, and I just want to tell you, too, that you may not hear anything this morning that you can relate to. There's a possibility that that might happen. And you know what? If that happens, it's okay. Just come back to the next meeting. Because eventually, if you keep coming back, you're going to hear someone that's going to plant a tiny seed. It doesn't matter what it is. And it doesn't matter who they are or what they look like. They're going to plant the seed when you're ready to hear it. When you're ready to hear it. My story is, I think it's pretty incredible. You know, as every one of our stories are in this room. But I know mine. I've lived through it, so I know what a powerful testament to Alcoholics Anonymous I am. Yeah. I was born 43 years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, and, you know, I literally have grown up in this program. I got sober when I was 26 years old, and while I came in here thinking I was the pussycat's meow at 26, thinking I had known everything, at 26 I knew nothing. I literally have grown up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was born, when I was growing up as a child, I don't remember a lot about that stuff that happened to me as a kid, but I can tell you what stands out for me most growing up in the South, growing up as a small child, was that more than anything else, I hated who I was. I think more than anything else, if I had to tell you just a bit of where I came from as a kid, it was that I hated who I was. I hated being in the skin. I hated being in this body. You know, it was always like there was a party going on somewhere, and I was on the other side desperately wanting to become a part of the party. That's all I ever wanted. You know, as a child, I didn't even want to be better than you. That didn't come until much later. As a kid, I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be on level with you. I wanted to just blend in with the crowd. And I never could. You know, it was like I was one of those round pegs in a square hole, always trying to fit in and just never could find the right connection to make that happen. As a kid who hated being in my skin, and I'll tell you, there were times when I wished I could just unzip my skin and step out and be anybody other than who I was. I hated being black. I hated being a woman or a girl at that time. I hated being a southerner. If you can possibly imagine, I used to have a very, very, very strong southern drawl when I was 6 years old. Very strong. And when I moved up to New York when I was 6 years old, the kids used to laugh at me and make fun of me. And I used to purposely stand in the mirror and practice not having an accent because I hated who I was. I just hated being in this body. There was a wonderful television movie that was on about 5, 6, 7 years ago. I'm not even sure. Now, it was called Separate But Equal. And I always like to talk about this movie when I speak because better than anything I could tell you about how I felt, this movie described it to a T. It was a movie about the former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's efforts to effectuate change in this country. It had to do with the Brown v. Board of Education case, which at that time integrated schools in the United States. And they were trying to understand the impact of segregation on very, very small children. So they had a large control group of kids, and they put them in a room, and they asked them a battery of questions. And in responding to each one of those questions, they had four little dolls that were sitting in front of them. They had a little black boy doll, they had a little white boy doll, a little black girl doll, and a little white girl doll. And they just asked them all kinds of questions, and then they came to this little black girl, and they didn't ask her anything complicated or major. They simply asked her to pick out the ugly doll of all four of the dolls that were sitting in front of her. That's all. They said, of the dolls in front of you, pick out the one for you that's just the ugliest of all four. And I can tell you without hesitation, without blinking her eye, this little kid grabbed a hold of the doll that looked exactly like herself. Because for her, that was the doll that was ugly. When she looked at herself in the mirror, the image she saw back was her own, and it was not the image she wanted to see. And I can tell you, that's how I felt all my life as a kid. Like I wasn't good enough, I hated who I was, all that stuff that I bet you, many of you felt too. Which is the wonderful gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you know, when I got sober, I found out that it didn't matter what you look like, didn't matter where you came from, didn't matter what your cultural background was, that beneath the surface, and when you put the 2% of the things that made us different, like skin color and hair color and eye color, that we all felt the same inside, or many of us did, feelings of differentness. And with that as a background, it wasn't a surprise to anyone who had enough caring, if you will, to pay attention to me as a child. It wasn't a surprise that eventually I was going to find something that was going to make that pain go away. Because the pain was lodged in my gut so strongly. Probably had I not found chemicals or something external, I would have taken my life, and I believe that today anyway. But as a child, my earliest escape in life came through books and movies, and it was wonderful. I loved books, and I loved old movies. My mother's a librarian, so we had tons of books in my house. I mean, it was so fabulous. In every room, on every wall, there were reams and reams of books, you know, all kinds of books. And sometimes I'd go and I'd just take a book off the shelf and I'd start to read in a corner by myself. And my mother, I think, used to believe that I was just trying to become a smart kid, you know. But what was really happening for me is that every time I opened up a book, there was like a safety for me. I experienced some kind of solace. When I opened up those binders, between them was heaven for me. Even if it was temporary, it made me feel okay just for a moment. Like I was all right with the world. And it was the same way with those old movies. I loved women like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. They were my idols. They were women that had a glass in one hand. They had a cigarette in the other hand. Hello. You know the story. They didn't take too much garbage off of anybody, you know. And I needed that. I mean, here I was, this little kid with this huge hole in her gut. And all I wanted was to cling to something that seemed stronger than me. Something that could just get me through the day. And the interesting thing is I share about this sometimes primarily because it's embarrassing to me, but it's the truth and it just keeps me at on that level where I need to remain, my feet on the ground. I learned a lot about being a female by watching these women. Now, I actually learned how to smoke cigarettes. I don't smoke anymore and I haven't smoked for over 13 years. But I smoked for 16 years, thanks to Betty Davis. In the movie, All About Eve, if you remember, she's walking up that staircase with that long, sexy cigarette holder talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride, you know? Had she only known how bumpy a ride it was going to be. But she was one of my role models. I watched her, and I used to stand in the mirror as this little sick kid, puffing circles, I'd be choking in between. For those of you that smoke, I'd puff and smoke and puff and smoke. But I learned how to do it. You know, I was a real good addict. I learned how to do that. And likewise, I still hold my glass with my pinky stuck out, you know. And I learned that by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet, you know. Those sexy women, those were my role models. And I have to tell you, all that says, I think, about me is that as a child, I was really impressionable. You know, I wanted desperately to be somebody other than who I was, and it worked. It worked. For a long time, when I read books and when I watched those old black and white movies, they took me to a place that was okay. Okay. And then, like everything external that any of us have ever used, it started to fail me. The books and the movies just started to fail me. Instead of making me realize that I wasn't really living in the environment that I was actually living in, instead of taking me to another place, what I started to realize was that this was my life, whether I liked it or not. You know, that eventually the books close, eventually the movies go off, and here I am in the South Bronx, this poor little black kid, and that was the deal. And I can't stand up here and tell you that on a conscious level, the realization that this was the hand that I was dealt and I had to accept it was the thing that tipped me over the edge. But I do believe on a subconscious level that that realization on some level just screamed out for some kind of support, for something to make it different. And what happened for me at the age of 14 is I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol. From the age of 14 until the age of 26, when I crawled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was not one single day that went by that I didn't use something to get through a day. Not one day went by. I'm a product of the 60s, and I grew up in New York City, so it was really easy for me to get caught up in that using mentality. You know, it was about better living through chemistry. You use chemicals to come up. You use chemicals to come down. You use chemicals to level you off. Always a bottle in my hand, always a pill, always a bag, always something to take me to another place. And part of that for me, part of the reason I thought that was acceptable is because I was an artist. I had gone to the High School of Art and Design in New York, and I bought that old garbage that they used to say that the more wasted you are, the more creative you become, you know. That's what they said in the 60s. They said, stay closed-eyed, and you could just paint away. You could snap pictures. I just heard, I guess it was the other day, Timothy Leary, who was one of our gurus. You know, this man died at 75, still saying, you know, go for it. And that's what I grew up with, listening to that kind of stuff. Although I have to tell you, on an honest level, I didn't need any of that. I never needed an excuse to use and drink. I just did it. And you know, one of the things I've come to realize in the last few years is that for me, and it's only for me, had I had a crystal ball and been able to look down the road at my life as it was to unfold for the next few years, there is no way in the world I would have picked up a drink or a drug and opted to live the way I eventually lived as a woman alcoholic. There is no way in the world I would have done it. I would not have consciously walked into the lion's den had I had a choice way back when, or had I known I had a choice. Instead, what would have happened for me, and it's just that simple, my mother would have probably come home and found me dead. My throat might have been slashed. My wrist might have been slashed. In L.A. a few months ago, they talked about two young kids, and it happens all the time, where kids take their life because they can't handle the pain of reality. And you know what? Had I been able to look down the road and see where my life was to, the path it was to take over the next few years, there's no way I would have said yes to that experience. I would have just ended it. But I've come to believe in my gut. I really have come to believe that everything happens in God's world, not by accident. There are no accidents. And I believe that probably the reason that I didn't take my life years ago is because of the one person that's sitting in the room this morning. Could be a man, could be a woman. But I believe there's one person in here today who needs to know that you can get from point A to point C through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter how far down that scale you go, no matter how dirty and degraded you feel inside when you crawl in here, that there's one person that needs to know that you can become like the phoenix that arises from the ashes and become the most productive person in your life for you today. That's what my story's about. It's about walking through fear and overcoming the odds, one day at a time. In 1978, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was, I remember reading the Big Book, and the chapter, More About Alcoholism, talks about that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I can tell you, when I got sober, there was not one single person in the room that had to sit me down and say, Francine, this is what it feels like to be a woman who feels pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. There's not one of you that had to explain what that was to me. Because, you see, I knew what that was about. As a woman alcoholic who had been out in the streets for more years than I'd like to admit, I had compromised myself to the point that I didn't even realize what I was doing was a compromise. I knew what it felt like to feel dirty all over all the time. I knew what it felt like to give up my power to anybody who was willing to take it. I knew what it felt like to sell my soul because I didn't think it was worth anything. I knew what it felt like to feel dirty all over all the time. There were times at the end of my drinking when I'd be standing under the shower just trying to get the dirt off. I'd scrub my skin and I'd scrub it and I'd scrub it. And sometimes I'd scrub so hard I'd get abrasions on my skin because I'd scrub so hard trying to take that dirt off. And for those of you that are real alcoholics, you know the kind of dirt I'm talking about. The kind that doesn't come off with soap and water. But I kept trying to take it off because that's what I thought it was about. And it wasn't until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous years later that you taught me that the cleansing process had to come from inside of me. That it wasn't about cleaning my body. It wasn't about wearing the right clothes. Wasn't about having the right amount of jewelry or being attached to the right man or living in the right neighborhood. That it was about how I behaved as a woman inside. That's what it was about. And the sad reality for me is I didn't understand that at the end of my drinking because at the very end, I had long since seen the poverty that I had grown up in as a child. I mean, I grew up in the South Bronx in New York, and by the end of my drinking, before I moved to Las Vegas, I was living on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, wearing diamonds and furs, going to Studio 54. So I knew I had arrived. I knew it. I knew the fact that I could walk in the door of Studio 54 made me somebody. I believed that. I knew that the fact that my benefactors were very, very wealthy men who were willing to spend fortunes on me, I knew that made me someone. And yet the sad reality is I couldn't stop drinking, I couldn't stop using drugs, and I couldn't stop compromising myself as a woman constantly. It didn't matter about those external things. They never made me feel clean, and they never made me feel whole. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in July or sometime in the summer of 1978, and I believe it was June or July. I don't remember. I was introduced to it in New York, and like the good little alcoholic I was then, I knew I didn't belong. I just knew I didn't belong. I mean, my conception of an alcoholic was that old man on the Bowery with the overcoat over his body and the bottle hanging out of the back of his pocket. That was an alcoholic with the veins that were red sticking out of his face. That was an alcoholic man. And if it was a woman by chance, which I knew there really weren't women alcoholics, but if there were, I mean, the only woman alcoholic I knew about, well, there were two, Lee Remick, you know, and Susan Haywood, and I'll Cry Tomorrow. Days of Wine and Roses, and I'll Cry Tomorrow. I mean, I grew up on the movies. That was my pacifier. So those two were women alcoholics, and I truly wasn't like either one of them. Susan Haywood was digging in the garbage can in that movie one day, and I tell you, I was living on East 58th Street. That was not me. And yet, the power of alcoholism is so incredible. They talk about this disease being cunning, baffling, and powerful, and I can attest to that fact. You know, they say often, or when I got sober, they would talk about alcoholism being a disease of perception. How easy it is to look at a picture and see only what I want to see out of that picture. Well, the reality is I used to dig out of the garbage can. When I saw her do it, I never thought I did. But when I used to smoke cigarettes, I remember at the end of my drinking, I couldn't get to a bar or the after-hour spot was closed or something, and I'd dig in the bottom of the garbage can for those nasty butts that I had already smoked all the way down to the filter, and I'd burn my lips and I'd burn my fingers just for the last puff. Or I'd dig at the bottom of the garbage can for the drop that was in the bottle, just the drop in the corner, or I'd lick the brim, because I was so pathetic at the end. Or I remember one night, my animals had the nerve to knock over my blow on the carpet. And like a sick, pathetic animal, I was sniffing cocaine out of the carpet. You know? If I ever for a moment even act like I don't belong here, you need to smack me. You know? that disease of perception. So in 1978, I just didn't believe I belonged here. And thank God for those of you that were here when I first came. You know, I just want to take this opportunity to say that I'm grateful for those people who didn't throw me out when I first crawled in here when they knew I was drinking and using. And they knew it. You know, I used to think they couldn't smell the vodka through my pores and, you know, but they knew I was on something. And I believe almost at every AA meeting I go to, there's somebody in the room that's drinking and using. And I just want to say for those of you in here this morning that are, I'm so glad you're here. I am so glad you're here. I'd rather that you be sitting in this room this morning than be sitting in a bar. You know, I am so grateful you're here. I want to also say to you, however, if you think we don't know that you're on something, think again. You know, it's not difficult to smell booze through the pores. It's not difficult to spot constricted or dilated pupils. You know, I used to sit in the back just knowing they couldn't get it. And they got it. You know, but we want you here anyway. We just want you here anyway. And how grateful I am that you guys didn't say to me, because I was a wet drunk, I didn't belong in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you. Because it was because of you that when I really was ready to come back, I knew it was an okay place to come. I knew that because you had welcomed me the first time. I moved out to Las Vegas, Nevada in 1978 on what I like to call a geographic, and you guys taught me that word. I have to tell you, I didn't have a clue what it meant when I got sober. And if you're new and you don't know, it simply means if you move from point A to point C thinking that you've left all your baggage at point A, think again, you know, because you take it all with you. And so I left New York. It was my mother's fault. She didn't burp me right. That's why I turned out like I did. It was all those men. They forced me to take all that money and those diamonds. I mean, they forced me to do it. It was the war in Vietnam. It was anybody's fault but mine. And so I moved out to Las Vegas just thinking that I was leaving all that stuff behind me, and of course I didn't. And I moved out to Vegas in November of 1978, and it took about 9 months for this most loving God that I didn't even believe in at the time to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I got hit by a car in a blackout in June of 1979, and today I don't even remember what happened. I can tell you that. I don't try to remember anymore, but in the beginning I used to try to remember the particulars, and I never could. I never was capable of separating the real from the unreal. What I had found out from the police when they found me on the street where I lived, Paradise Road, in a direction opposite from my house. And when they found me, I'm told they didn't think I was going to live. And when they realized I was going to live, they never thought I'd ever walk again, because my left leg was up behind my head and the bone had come straight through. And I walk with a limp today. I have a really ugly scar. It's about 10 inches long with a lot of holes in it. And I don't hide it. I wear short skirts. I wear shorts. I wear bathing suits. And I've been asked if I'd ever consider cosmetic surgery, because it really is an unattractive scar. I mean, if you stare at it, you know, it really is ugly. And I can only tell you that just for today, I choose not to cover it up. You know, who knows? Maybe the day will come when I'll want to cover it up. But for today, every time I look at my leg, I'm reminded of the very high price I had to pay to stand before you this morning. I'm reminded of every drink I took, of every drug I took, and of every inappropriate act as a woman I performed. And so just for today, that's one of those guiding forces that keeps me on the beam, keeps me on that AA beam. I'd like to tell you that that was enough to get me in here, but for those of you that are real deal alcoholics, you know that no mere car accident so sick. No car accident's going to stop you if you're on a mission. Yeah. And it didn't stop me. I continued to drink for another... Thank you, but no ice, please. I continued to drink for another month and a half. And And then what I like to call that moment of clarity. It happened for me, as I know it's happened for each and every one of us that sits in this room today that's sober. It happened for us at some point. And that moment of clarity just came for me. I hadn't picked up a drink for about 5 days. I was in this apartment in Las Vegas. And I like to share this because it was my last drunk. It wasn't my worst, but it was, I just like to share it. My last drunk was I had come from the doctor thinking that the doctor was going to remove the cast that was on my leg. It was a month and a half, and I thought it was about time, quite honestly, that it came off. I mean, anybody that's ever been to Vegas in the summer knows it's hot, 120 in the shade. But then if you have a cast on your leg, it's really brutal. And I just was ready for this thing to come off, and I came from the doctor, and he wouldn't take it off because it was a compound fracture. I mean, my leg was shattered. And so the good little alcoholic that I've always been, I, en route from the doctor, I remember whoever it was that picked me up, I stopped by the liquor store, and I should have known the end was near. I should have known. No offense to anybody that drank this stuff, but it truly was not my drink of choice. I stopped by the liquor store, and I picked up 3 bottles of Blue Nun. For me, I mean, I'm sorry, I was a Cristal drinker, you know. 3 bottles of Blue Nun, and I really should have known this was the time. I drank all 3 bottles, which was really the deal, and the next thing I remember was I came to in this incredible apartment that had the potential of being beautiful. It had the potential. I had a wonderful apartment in Vegas. It was called Las Palmas. It's a huge complex with a lot of beautiful palm trees, and I had a garden apartment, and on right out front of my door was a little brook, and they used to keep little ducklings inside, and it was really lovely. I mean, it was so tranquil. It was just so pretty. And anybody who was healthy could appreciate that. You know. Inside of my apartment, it also had the potential of being nice. It had stucco walls and wood-paneled walls and wall-to-wall carpeting. But what you found in there was pretty barren, and what you found in there, when you walked into my apartment, you were smacked in the face with the stench of human waste and animal waste. Because at the end of my drinking, I was so totally incapable of taking care of myself as a human being or my animals. I couldn't take care of my cats. I couldn't take care of myself. And on this particular night, I came to about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I remember it was like early wee hour of the morning, and I came to with my door wide open and my crutches on one side of the room, and I was in the nude just lying in my own waste because I couldn't take care of myself. And I want never to forget that image because, you see, that's not who I am today. I don't look that way. I don't smell that way. I don't treat myself or my animals that way. And I don't drink or use drugs today. But I never, ever want to forget that that was where I ended up, held hostage in my own apartment because I couldn't move. I was 26 years old, and I couldn't take care of myself. I called Alcoholics Anonymous 5 days later in Las Vegas and said I'd like to go to a meeting. And I knew to call you guys from the year before in New York. I knew to call you. And the woman who was there said, I don't think I can get anybody to you right now, but if you can just hold on, we'll get someone to pick you up tomorrow and take you to a meeting. And I happened to believe that the God that I didn't even believe in at the time knew I was not going to survive another 24 hours. And so I got a telephone call a little while later from a woman who lived in the complex right next door to mine. And she said, Francine, if you'd like to go to a meeting, I'd be happy to take you. You know, just another one of those coincidences. You know? That was my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas, and I pray to God it's my last first meeting anywhere. I pray to God. I pray to God I never have to go back out and find out what it's like to get sober again, because I must tell you for myself, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't make it. Not only do I not think I have another recovery, I don't think I have another complete drunk. Because when I was out there, I had a really bad mouth, if you can imagine. Think hard. I had a really, just the attitude alone, I had a really bad mouth. And I would, after I was drinking and using only, I would get up into big people's faces and let them know how I felt about them. And on several occasions, I must tell you, I was found on the floor, you know, once with somebody's boot in my face. And so I know with a little bit of sobriety and some booze in my belly, somebody would just kill me the next time, you know. And if they didn't kill me, I think what's really more sad is I'd probably take my own life. I'd probably get the courage this time to take my own life. Because there's no way I'd want to be drinking after having the kind of sobriety I've enjoyed. There's no way. And so, because I don't want to even find out what might happen, I don't pick up today. I've become willing a day at a time to do what is necessary to stay close. To stay close. You know, this is wonderful. This conference is a wonderful conference, especially for me because it's also mixing the service element of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been weaned in this program on service. I just had the privilege of serving this program as a director on the corporate board of the Grapevine, and I just rotated off the board in April. And, you know, I always appreciate the service that people do on every level. I've had an opportunity to be involved in service through general service. I have an opportunity to share my story like this. To me, this is service. I have an opportunity to work with newcomers and do all kinds of things, and it's all important. It's all important. It's all important. But I didn't learn that until later. I came in here and I had a really bad attitude. And that's just such an understatement. I can't even begin to tell you how bad the attitude was. Just bring to mind a New Yorker who's newly sober, who thinks she's the hottest thing since sliced bread anyway, you know, with very little recovery. I mean, that was like the attitude. I came in here, but mostly it was that I was angry. See, the attitude was really a cover-up, and I came to realize that. The attitude, the cockiness when I was new, it was just really because I was so afraid inside. It was anger and it was fear. And that was the way I'd cover it up, by being really tough, by thinking I was better than. But once you pierced the surface, you got to realize I was a scared little kid who just wanted somebody to love me for who I was, who just wanted somebody to appreciate me, not for my body, not for my face, but just because of who I was. And I think, deep down, that's what I've always wanted. Just to be loved for who I am. You know, when I speak at conferences and I get to travel a lot, I don't wear, I wear my speaker tag, but I always take off the speaker part of it. Usually they're tag that they treat you differently, even if they don't mean to. You know, sometimes it happens. And when I take that tag off, people just connect with me as a human being. People were fabulous to me this week, and even people I didn't know, just because I was another alcoholic, not because I was the Sunday morning speaker. You know, all I ever wanted was just to be able to connect with you. I came in with such a bad attitude. I'd sit on the side of the room with the people who said, honey, all you have to do is take up a seat, and you're going to get this deal through osmosis. Please. I can tell you, I didn't even know what it meant. And if and if you're new, just to let you know, what osmosis simply means is if you sit next to someone who's sober and rub up against them, you're going to catch it like that. You're going to catch sobriety. It's a scientific term, and it means absorption. And I wanted to believe that. I wanted to believe that I wasn't required to do anything in here. I wanted to believe that my presence alone was going to get me over. Well, it doesn't. It didn't for me. I can only say that. You know, I didn't like men and I didn't like women when I got sober, and that was a surprise to a lot of people, especially the fact that I didn't like men, because I was always attached to a man when I came in here. Always. I'm one of those women that has never been able to function without a boyfriend in my life. And when I got sober, I realized that there was a lot of anger lodged deep inside of me and that I really didn't like guys. And one of the greatest gifts of my recovery has been the healing. And, you know, now among my closest friends are men. A couple of them are in here today. You know, among my closest friends. And as a result, I'm always grateful to those men, and I always like to say it from the podium, thank you to those men who allowed me to get sober when I was new. Because that's the reason I love men so much today. Thank you to those men who didn't try to 13-step me, who just let me get sober, who wanted to be my friend and help me, but who just let me get sober, because perhaps had I had a lot of other experiences, I might not have had the wonderful role models that I had. But I love men today because of you guys. because of those of you that let me get sober. But this disliking men wasn't the real issue for me. When I came in, I realized how much I disliked women. And again, it was about me. It wasn't about you guys. It was that when I looked at myself in the mirror, the image that I looked back at was not the image I wanted to see. I thought that most women were not to be trusted because I wasn't to be trusted. I slept with other people's husbands. I slept with other people's boyfriends. I did all kinds of inappropriate things, and so I thought you were like me. And the ones who I knew weren't like me, I wasn't crazy about them, because they'd get up to the podium, and it was like they were Little Miss AAs, you know. I hated the women who would get up here and say, just for today, I behaved differently, thank you, you know. I didn't want to hear that at all, because I was still in the mire. I was still acting inappropriately, coming to meetings with hot pants up to my navel and coming to meetings with blouses open down to my navel. I know, and sleeping with anybody who I could. It didn't matter who it was, you know. And yet the irony of it is when the time came for me to change as a woman in this program, it was the women who had the guts and the courage to be different, to use the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to change their lives. They were the women that I wanted what they had. Women like my sponsor. My first sponsor, Louise, out of Las Vegas, she taught me from the very beginning that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. So she taught me. She said, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She said, if you act like a whore, you're going to be treated like a whore. She said, if you dress like a hooker, you're going to be treated like a hooker. She said, if every other word out of your mouth is a four-letter word, then don't be surprised if you get that message back. That self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She taught me so much about who I am today as a woman. You know, she taught me how to respect myself as a woman by acting differently. And I can tell you, one day at a time, I do not sleep with other people's husbands. I do not sleep with other people's boyfriends and justify that it's not their husband, you know. That was good. That was a real good one. I'd say, well, they're not married, I mean. No, it doesn't work that way for me. For me, just for today. One day at a time, I choose not to use four-letter words. You know, and again, that's just for me. I found when I first came in, I cursed like a sailor. I mean, any naval officers in there? I had a filthy mouth, let's just say that. Off the streets, I had a really filthy mouth. And what I found was in meetings, when I was new, every time I cursed, I got people to laugh. I mean, people laughed every time I cursed. It was wonderful. It was like that negative reinforcement. And for me, negative reinforcement is better than no reinforcement. At least they knew I was present. And my sponsor said to me one day, Francine, there will come a time when you'll make a choice as to what's more important, feeling good about yourself inside or having people laugh because you string a sentence full of curse words. And it was hard for me to stop doing that. I have to tell you, I mean, she taught me how to do it slowly. Let's say I had 6 curse words in a sentence, she'd help me reduce it to 3, you know. And that's kind of funny, but it's exactly how it happened for me. And then she'd have me maybe have 1 curse word in a sentence, and then every other sentence had 1 word. And you know, over the years before I knew it, I wasn't cursing. I was choosing to use other words to describe how I felt. It blows me away. Sometimes I have to even catch myself. When I might even want to say something, but I think of another word. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. For me, it's an esteemable act to use a different word to describe how I feel. When I was 2 years sober, as the insides were changing, the outsides were also changing. And it's a major deal for me. I was a high school dropout, and primarily because education was never important to me. I can assure you not one of my benefactors ever asked me where I went to finishing school. They didn't care. You know, they didn't care whether I had a degree or any kind of diploma. All that mattered to them was that I was capable of performing, that I looked the part and I could be taken anywhere. And, you know, up until that point, that's all that mattered to me, too. You know, up until the time I was 2 years sober, all I thought was important was the image, how I looked on the outside. But at 2 years sobriety, as a result of some of these things that were starting to change inside of me, I realized I no longer wanted to be someone's mistress anymore. I wanted my self-esteem to come from me, from God. And so I made a decision to go back to school when I was 2 years sober. to pursue a career that was going to require about 10 years of a commitment. And I can tell you, I couldn't spell commitment and I couldn't define it. I didn't have a clue. But what I had at 2 years sobriety was a sponsor who believed that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She believed that the sky was the limit if I was willing to do the work to get to where I wanted to be. She said to me over and over again, "Francine, if you want to use your race as an excuse for not showing up in this world," she said, "go for it." She said, "if you want to use the fact that you're a girl for not advancing yourself, fine, you can do that too." She said, "if you want to use your past as an excuse for why you can't move ahead, use it." But she said, if you want the 12 steps, if you want to be in another place, the 12 steps will help you be there. But it's important that you become willing to do the work. And one day at a time, I didn't believe in myself, but I had a sponsor who believed in me. And I have to tell you, sometimes I question whether she did, but she acted as if. You know? Who knows? I mean, quite honestly, to have gotten from where I was to where I got to in that career, I don't know if I would have believed somebody would have done it at the time. But she acted as if, because she loved me so much that she was just willing to be there for me. I got my GED in 1981. I had been out of school for 10 years. And I started college at UNLV in Las Vegas. And in 1982, I moved back to New York City to work my way through college. I worked full-time. I went to school full-time. And I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And it's really important that I say that from the podium, because all too often I sit in meetings and I hear newcomers between those very delicate years of 1 and 5 who are all back in life. You know, they all have the right job, they're in the right relationship, they're back in school, and nobody has time to go to meetings. Nobody. They're just too busy. And on the rare occasion they get to a meeting, those of us that have been sitting here all the time have to listen to the stuff that's been built up. You know, built up. And I just want to say, in defense of anyone in here who's in that place, yes, sobriety works under those conditions. But what I was taught is that why have to go it the hard way? You know, yeah, you can do it like that if you want. But I was taught to use Alcoholics Anonymous as a preventive measure. I had a sponsor who consistently told me that the only reason I was in school was because of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was the truth, because believe me, where I came from, there was no mention of school. There was no school. So the only reason I was sitting in anybody's classroom struggling through the reading and doing all the other work, but at least showing up, was because of you. And she also reminded me that I had a responsibility to pass on a message of hope and inspiration, and that the only way I could do that is if I was sitting where you guys were sitting, in AA meetings. So grudgingly, I showed up at meetings. I'm not going to tell you I did it and loved it. Grudgingly, I'd show up in meetings after school and after work, and it was awful. But, you know, I kept showing up. And thank God, because when the time came, when there was a snag in my sobriety, when I started going through a really difficult period a few years later, having to do with school and this career, it was only because I kept coming to you, and I let you see how I was feeling. I didn't hide behind my years of sobriety. I kept showing up, talking about what was going on. I graduated from college in 1986, and I moved down to Washington, D.C. in 1989 to complete my education. And in 1989, I moved back to New York City, having graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I can tell you, it might not impress too many people in here, but it still rings a bell in my brain. You know, it is still hard for me to believe that I, one day at a time, got to that dream that I wanted. You know, I'm the kid who people used to consistently say, "Don't go for the moon. You're going to only get disappointed. Go for the top of the fence. You can handle that. That's reasonable. That's a reasonable expectation. But don't go for the moon. Leave it to those other people. You're going to only fail and be disappointed." And I'm here to say, if there's anybody in this room who's a dreamer like me, don't you dare let people do that to you. Don't you dare let them tell you you can't have what you want. You go for the moon. You can have anything you want in this program if you are willing to do the work. And that's the key. If you're not willing to do the work, then that's another story. But if you're willing to do what it takes, and sometimes it's heavy sacrifices, like social life, like boyfriends, like girlfriends, But if you become willing to do what it takes, then you can have the goals you want, whether it's a career choice, whether it's having a wonderful relationship with somebody, whether it's having a relationship with your family, whether it's just being in a more centered, wonderful place. It doesn't matter where it is. Maybe it's trying something new. Maybe it's moving to another city. But you can have the dreams that you want. For me, sobriety is about dreams. It's about dreams. My passion today gives me the incentive to move to the next level. Because sometimes I get bogged down with all the little stuff around me. All the little stuff. And when I keep my goal in sight, I get to move forward. The good news, too, is that you can have lots of goals. Lots of dreams. I became a lawyer in Alcoholics Anonymous, and now I don't even want to practice law anymore. You know? And it was a struggle to get there. It was very much a struggle to get there. I graduated from Georgetown in 1989, and I sat for the New York bar on my 10th anniversary. And it was so awesome, I have to tell you. Sitting for the exam, mostly because I turned 10. But to be able to turn 10 and sit for this exam, I mean, the only bar I knew about up until that point, you know. That's right, it wasn't one you wrote. But I sat for the bar, and I remember going into that exam with my coin in my left hand and writing that test, and I was so prepared. I went in, and I failed the test, you know. The worst thing that could have happened to me, it happened. The worst thing that could have happened. I mean, I sat in meetings just complaining and moaning and groaning. Poor me, look at this. There's something wrong with this picture. This is not fair. 10 years I've turned my life around. I'm of service. I do all the right stuff. This is not fair. I studied. I failed the test. The operative words here are that I sat in meetings talking about that, though. I sat in AA meetings, and as a result, you gave me the courage I needed to take it again. And I sat for the bar for the second time, and I failed it again. And I can tell you it does not get easy with long-term sobriety to fail exams. You know, believe me, I've had lots and lots and lots of experience. But what got easier for this alcoholic was my willingness to get up and dust myself off and start all over again. See, I know what it's like to be a giver-upper. I know what it's like to stand on the sidelines and take the inventory of the doers. I've been there, done that, and I did it well. Because I was so envious of them. I would call it something else, but I was so envious of those that even had the courage to try. You gave me the courage to take it another time, and I eventually passed it. And I was admitted to the New York bar. And, you know, it blows me away today that I don't even want to practice law anymore. And I've struggled for the last few years with bar exams, California, New York. I had a difficult time with the California bar, more so than with New York. And I let the exam go about a year and a half ago. And it was the most freeing and painful experience at one time I could go through. Many of you that heard me speak over the last few years of struggling with that exam, I became willing to let it go because I found I had gotten to a point in my sobriety about a year and a half ago where I was so totally consumed with this exam. My body was like this. I was so tight. All I did was sit for the bar, think about sitting for the bar, wait for the results, or something. And it consumed me. And it wasn't even that I wanted to practice in California. I mean, you know, I had already been practicing. I had already reached that goal, but, you know, I thought I had to do it. And I let go of it a year and a half ago, and I must tell you, when I let go of it, my life turned around. There was such a sense of freedom that took place inside of me. You know, it's ironic, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about independence. True independence of the spirit comes from a dependence on a power greater than ourselves. And what happened is I found I had been holding on and putting God somewhere in the back shelf. And when I let go, the irony of it is exactly what I thought I wanted, I got. Right now, I am currently in-house counsel at a consulting firm down in Los Angeles, and I never, ever would have planned to be at this place. But what I have found is that God strategically placed me there. It's an organization that does what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We do a lot of team building and leadership stuff in large companies that are dysfunctional. We help to turn them around. As an AA, we take dysfunctional people and like to turn us around, you know. And I, over the last year and a half, I kept saying to God, ideally what I would love to do as a profession is what I do in AA, when I get to speak, to be able to motivate and make a difference in people's lives. And then God put this job in my life. And I would have never been able to get into that job had I not been their lawyer. You know, they would have never even looked at my resume because I didn't have the consulting background that they needed. But I've gotten permission to train as a consultant. And for the last month and a half, I've been training as one of their consultants to do the kind of stuff that I get to do with you. Just share who I am. Just try to make a difference in people's lives. I don't have a clue where I am headed. I have no idea. I have no idea where the next 16, 17 years are going to take me. I have no idea where the career path is going to take me. But I trust in this process today. I know that wherever God takes me, it's going to be an incredible place. And the journey is going to be the real gift. I believe that. I believe that because it's already happened. My life has unfolded in such an incredible way. When I was newly sober, I was invited to make a list of all the things I wanted out of my sobriety. And on that list, you would have found a litany of every single material thing I lost. You would have found fur coats and diamond rings and kitty cats and stereos. That's what you would have found. You would have never once found the things that I value the most today. Those intangibles that nobody can take away from me. Those intangibles like self-esteem. The kind, the genuine kind today for me that comes not from being attached to the right mate, but the kind that comes from walking through fear. You know, I'm one of those people who believes that every time I do something that I'm afraid of doing, it's like a little check next to my name. And likewise, I get the courage to then do something else I'm afraid of doing. What you'd find on that list for me today is courage. I never had courage. And quite honestly, I'm probably one of the most fearful people you will ever meet in your life. I wake up sometimes in the morning so scared. You know, you guys are talking about being afraid when you got up here to read. I'm always afraid every single time I get up to the podium. But the difference between me today and me yesterday is I show up anyway. See, I walk through the fear. That's what gives me the courage. Discipline is something you'd find on my list, and it almost hurts me to say that word. Discipline, you know. And yet today I am so disciplined, it's incredible. You know, I was one of those people who just couldn't get into deferred gratification. It was not something I wanted, you know. I didn't want to have to wait. I wanted what I wanted yesterday, thank you. And today I'm one of those people that just sometimes has to wait. And it's about putting one baby foot in front of the other. Sometimes walking toward a goal that I can't even see. But the discipline comes from just showing up. What you'd also find on that list for me is the gift of my mother. I love my mother so much today. And what a switch that is. I hated my mother all of my life. All of my life. As far back as I can remember, I despised this woman. I despised the way she looked. Everything about her. And when people would tell me I'd look like her or I sounded like her on the phone, it was just like a dagger went into my gut. And when I got sober, thank God I had a sponsor who believed that healing needed to come from within and it needed to start at home. Thank God I had a sponsor who encouraged that. Because thanks to her, the relationship that I have today with my mother is incredible. And I didn't set out for that to happen. I didn't set out for that to happen. You know, but what Louise helped me recognize was that my mother truly did the very best she could with what she had. I was so busy blaming her for not being a good mother, and yet not once did I realize I was never a good daughter. Ever. Ever. I'd call my mother up on the phone and curse her out and tell her how she was responsible for the way I turned out. You know, and I did that all the time. I was never a good daughter. I did everything she didn't want me to do when I was growing up, and yet I expected her to be perfect, but I wanted her to understand that I was only human. You know. Today my mother is human. She's got warts, and so do I. That's the good news. So do I. And you know what? We've got an incredible relationship. We both work at it. We both work at it. What you'd also find on my list is good health. I feel better today at 43 than I have ever felt in my life. I think I look better than I've ever looked. Spiritually, I'm more connected than I've ever been. You know, I just recently ran the Los Angeles Marathon, and in December, I ran the Honolulu Marathon, which for me is like just a big deal because last August, I joined this running organization so that I could not run a marathon, but so I could take off some of the excess baggage I had put on. And one step at a time, I took. I followed their directions, and before I knew it, I ran two marathons in 3 months. And I couldn't walk when I got sober. The doctors didn't think I'd ever walk. You know? I'm in relatively good shape today for a middle-aged woman. You know? That's the good news. What you'd also find on that list is the gift of love. The gift of love. Well, you know, when I got sober, I looked at all of you, and I looked at the things that divided us. The 2% of the things that make us different. The skin color, the hair color, the religion. I never wanted to focus on the things that bound us, ever. And one day at a time, what you've taught me how to have is an open heart. That's what you've given me. You've taught me that it's so much easier to look at the things that make us separate from each other, but the real gift is to be a connector, to be a healer. That's what you've taught me. I love being sober so much. I love being sober at Alcoholics Anonymous. And in closing, I'd like to read something to you from conference-approved literature in case there are any AA purists in the room. I know there are. I've heard the messages up here. The purist. As Bill sees it, it's one of my most favorite books. I'm a book baby. I'm so grateful that I had a sponsor who really loved this program and believed that all the answers were in our books. All the answers. And she tricked me into reading the book sometimes. She'd say something, and I'd say, Louise, where'd you find that? And she'd say, oh, it's in the big book. And she'd help a little. She'd narrow it down maybe to a chapter, maybe. But I'd have to read through it in order to get it. And you know, the trick worked. The trick worked. And she had me read this book when I was really new because I was always so angry when I got sober. I mean, I like to say, I came into this program with my face in a pissed off position, you know. So she had me read everything in As Bill Sees It under anger and resentment. And then she asked me to read, well, she strongly suggested that I read everything under faith and gratitude. And you know what? I fell in love with this book as I've fallen in love with you guys. I just did. And I always like to end my talks with this passage. It's on page 4, and it's entitled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And that's what you've given me in 16-plus years of sobriety, the gift of choice. You've taught me that it doesn't matter where I've come from, doesn't matter what color my skin is, doesn't matter whether I have a religion or I believe in God or I don't, doesn't matter about any of that stuff. That you taught me that the only thing that matters is where I'm headed and how I treat you, my fellow travelers, along the way. That's what you've taught me. How I treat you, not only in an AA meeting, but how I treat you outside of the doors, in traffic, in the supermarket, on the teller's line at the bank. You know, how I treat you out there, that's what you've taught me. And all you have ever asked of me in the years I'm sober, all that you have ever, ever asked of me, is that I always be willing to pass it on. And for that, I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.